Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Daniel 11. I'm going to cover verses 16 through 30. We will continue with the wars between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies that Daniel is prophesying about here. He was prophesying in the third year of Cyrus, which puts him about 535 or 536 or so B.C. That means the third year after Cyrus had conquered Babylon in 539, but the date is not so important. It is just to show us how far in advance Daniel is prophesying, because these events are in the late or the early 2nd century B.C., and Daniel was prophesying in the 6th century B.C., over 400 years earlier. Now, we left off the story in the last audio with the king of the north being Antiochus III the Great. He ruled from 223 to 187. He was fighting his Ptolemaic adversary, Ptolemy V Epiphanes, in the Fifth Syrian War. And we left off where Antiochus the Great the Third was in charge. And remember, the Syrian wars were fought over the beautiful land Israel and also Coelus Syria, which is the land in present-day Lebanon between the Lebanon and anti-Lebanon ranges, right south of Syria, where the capital of the Seleucids were. And so Israel was the political football as the kings of the north and the kings of the south fought each other over that territory. We left off where Antiochus III had beaten the forces of Ptolemy V Epiphanes at Bania, Caesarea Philippi, and then at Sidon. And Sidon was finally taken by Antiochus III the Great. Ptolemy V's general Scopas was holed up there. That was 199. And at that time, the king of the north, Antiochus III, was supreme. So we begin now in Daniel 11:16. The king of the north who comes against him will do whatever he wants, and no one can oppose him. He will establish himself in the beautiful land with total destruction in his hand. Now the king of the north there is Antiochus the Great, and he comes against him. That's Ptolemy V Epiphanes, the two kings I've just mentioned. Pulpit commentator says, Ptolemy sent several successive armies to relieve Sidon, but was unable to compel Antiochus to give up the siege. Finally, Scopas, that's Ptolemy V's general, had to surrender. And so now Antiochus III can do whatever he wants in his conquered territory, which includes Israel, the whole Holy Land. He will establish himself in the beautiful land. Beautiful land is Israel, with total destruction in his hand. John Gill and Matthew Henry say that destruction came from the foraging of Antiochus III the Great's numerous army. There is a textual alternative here which says that Antiochus will establish himself in the beautiful land which by his hand was perfected. In other words, the beautiful land was restored to perfect peace and prosperity, which had been for some years before distressed by the Egyptians and Syrians in the battle. Or it could be the beautiful land was perfected because now Palestine has come under the complete control of Antiochus III the Great. That's Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's idea. But all my translations have destruction, so we're going to assume that Antiochus III destroyed everything in his path. He basically wiped out Israel and took it over. We go down to Daniel 11:17. He, that's Antiochus III the Great, will resolve to come with the force of his whole kingdom and will reach an agreement with him, an agreement with Ptolemy V Epiphanes. He, Antiochus III the Great, will give him, Ptolemy V Epiphanes, a daughter in marriage to destroy it. And that's hard to understand there, to destroy it. I'll get to that in a minute. So Antiochus III the Great will give Ptolemy V Epiphanes a daughter in marriage, but she will not stand with him or support him. Now in verse 17, Daniel says that Antiochus III the Great will resolve to come with the force of his whole kingdom. He was not satisfied with just winning the disputed territories. He wanted to come down and take over Egypt too. And so he heads on down to the south. They finally got tired of fighting. They had a marriage alliance. Ptolemy V Epiphanes was to give up all of his holdings in Asia, present-day Turkey. And Antiochus III the Great was to give up his daughter, Cleopatra I, so that she could go to Egypt and marry Ptolemy V Epiphanes. The marriage was in 194 B.C. She was said to be a beautiful virgin as she goes down there. Now, of course, the motive of Antiochus III the Great was not good. It was to destroy it. The Holman Christian Study Bible has. Let's look at some other translations. The Young's Literal Translation and the ASV and the Darby have to corrupt her. He gave Ptolemy the Fifth Epiphanes a daughter to corrupt her. The Bible in Basic English says he gave the daughter to send corruption on it, meaning the southern kingdom. God's word says he gave the daughter in order to destroy the southern kingdom. The KJV has he gave the daughter corrupting her. The New American Bible says he gave the daughter in order to destroy the kingdom. Here's the NESB. He will set his face to come with the power of his whole kingdom, bringing with him a proposal of peace, which he will put into effect. That's the marriage alliance. He will also give him the daughter of women to ruin it. In other words, to ruin the peace that the peace treaty was supposed to establish, because Antiochus III was a hypocrite. He meant for his daughter to wreak havoc upon the Ptolemies with her spying, her intrigue, her supporting her daddy, and so forth. But unfortunately, Antiochus III's plan did not work out, because in the end of verse 17 we read, "But she will not stand with him. Cleopatra the First stood with her husband, Ptolemy the Fifth Epiphanes, not her father, Antiochus III the Great." So, to summarize, this treaty was either used to corrupt his own daughter, she would be used for corrupt practices, or it was used to destroy the southern kingdom, depending on the translation. But the intent is clear. Cleopatra I became beloved in Egypt for standing by her man, Ptolemy V, and for betraying her husband, Antiochus III the Great. Here's how she stood by her man. This is from John Gill in Wikipedia. With her husband, Ptolemy V, she sent ambassadors out of Egypt congratulating the Romans on the victory the Romans had gained over Antiochus III the Great, her father. The Romans had driven Antiochus III the Great out of Greece. We read in Wikipedia, in 192, now this is 2 years after the marriage, in 192 B.C., Antiochus invaded Greece with a 10,000-man army and was elected the commander-in-chief of the Aetolian League. In 191 B.C., however, the Romans under Manius Acilius Glabrio routed him at Thermopylae, the famous Thermopylae, forcing him to withdraw to Asia Minor. So Antiochus had a great defeat. Her father was defeated and humiliated by the Romans, and his daughter said, "Hot dog, I'm so glad this happened. Thank you, Romans, for doing that to my dad." Not only that, she further exhorted the Romans to carry their army into Asia against her father, Antiochus III the Great. And we'll see that the last battle between the Romans and Antiochus III the Great took place in Asia Minor, in Phrygia, at a place called Magnesia. And she was urging that on. So Daniel was exactly right when he prophesied she will not stand with her father or support him. We go now to Daniel 11, verse 18. Then he will turn his attention to the coast and islands. That's Antiochus III the Great will. After he had gotten beaten in Greece, he turned his attention to the coast and islands and captured many. But a commander will put an end to his taunting. Instead, he will turn his taunts against him. All right, we've already talked about how Antiochus III the Great had gone into Greece. I didn't mention that when he got there, he had sent ambassadors to Rome asking for friendship. The Roman Senate said, "Fine, on two conditions. One, you leave the Greeks free and independent. Stay away from Europe." Antiochus III refused those conditions, went to war against Rome, and got beat. And then he sailed across the Aegean Sea through all those rocky Greek islands and took some strongholds in Asia Minor on the western coast of present-day Turkey. The coast and islands, that would be the coast of Asia Minor and the islands of the Aegean Sea, and he captured many. But a commander will put an end to his taunting. Now, who is that? Well, Clark says it's Manius Acilius Glabrio, the Roman military officer who defeated Antiochus in Greece at Thermopylae. I don't think so, because already now we've gotten over into the coast and the islands. We're back over into Asia Minor with Antiochus III the Great. And so Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says it's the Roman military officer Lucius Cornelius Scipio Asiaticus, who was the leader of the Roman troops at the Battle of Magnesia in 190. That was a very disastrous defeat for Antiochus III. And so that, I believe, is the commander who will put an end to the taunting of Antiochus III the Great. Now, after that battle, there was a peace treaty between the Seleucids and the Romans at Apamea, which is a town in Syria. Well, it was a city, actually, in Syria. The Peace of Apamea was in 188 B.C. It's a ruin now, but it's a great archaeological site. unfortunately, a lot of people have gone in there with bulldozers to plunder the historical artifacts, and Syrian rebels sold them on the worldwide black market for such antiquities in order to finance their killing, raping, and destruction. Well, at the Treaty of Apamea, Antiochus had to give 20 hostages to the Romans, and one of those hostages will show up here in just a minute, Antiochus IV Epiphanes, who ruled from 175 to 164. Well, before he took office in 175, head of the Seleucid Empire, he was in Rome as a hostage. Apamea also said that Antiochus III had to reduce his navy to 12 ships, and Antiochus III the Great had to pay to Rome 15,000 talents over the next 12 years to pay for the cost of the war. The Battle of Magnesia and Apamea ended the all-consuming ambition of Antiochus III the Great. It's not so great anymore. So we move now to Daniel 11:19. He, that's Antiochus III the Great, will turn his attention back to the fortresses of his own land. He had no choice. He had to go back to Syria. Greece and Asia Minor are now the property of the Romans. He will go back to the fortresses of his own land, but he will stumble, fall, and be no more. So Antiochus III has now been reduced to Syria, Mesopotamia, the western part of Iran. He goes back to his fortresses. That probably refers to the fortresses in his capital city at Antioch in Syria. And he will stumble and fall. Here's what happened to the great Antiochus III. In 187 B.C., being in dire need of funds to pay Rome for the cost of the war at the Treaty of Apamea, he was plundering a pagan temple near Susa in Persia, trying to get some money to pay the Romans, and he got murdered, got killed. So he will stumble, fall, and be no more, as Daniel predicted. We go now to Daniel 11:20. In his place one will arise who will send out a tax collector for the glory of the kingdom, but within a few days he will be shattered, though not in anger or in battle. Now who is this one that will arise who sends out a tax collector? His name is Seleucus IV Philopater, father lover. He loved his father, Antiochus III the Great, I presume. So he takes over in 187 after Antiochus III got killed plundering the pagan temple. Now his famous tax collector was a guy named Heliodorus. And by the way, I looked at a bunch of translations for tax collector because not all of them have tax collector. The NIV and the NAB has tax collector. The KJV has raiser of taxes. The English Standard Version has exactor of tribute. The American Standard Version and the Young's Literal Translation have an exactor. God's Word has a cruel official. The New American Standard Bible has an oppressor. Well, all those words describe Heliodorus. We're going to call him the tax collector. Now, Seleucus IV Philopater, that's the eldest son of Antiochus III the Great. The youngest son is Antiochus IV Epiphanes, our famous little horn of Daniel 8, so we'll get to him in a minute. But now the older son is in charge. He ruled from 187 to 175. He, of course, needed money to pay the Roman tribute that had been exacted at the Treaty of Apamea in 188 B.C., so he's looking for money, and that's why he sent out this Heliodorus to collect it. In addition to the money he needed for the Romans, he needed money for himself because he was very avaricious and greedy for himself. So Israel got taxed heavily at this time. In fact, Seleucus IV Philopater even sent Heliodorus to the temple in Jerusalem to extract money. Daniel prophesies that in verse 20. He says that he, that's Seleucus IV Philopater, sent out a tax collector for the glory of the kingdom. Now the NASB has for the jewel of the kingdom. And I don't think that means for the benefit of the jewel of the kingdom, the temple, or the city of Jerusalem. It means he sent out the tax collector for the purpose of taxing the jewel of the kingdom. Daniel continues, but within a few days he will be shattered. Now, a few days means within a short period of time. It doesn't mean literal days, of course. Here's what happened to Seleucus IV Philopater. In 175, he got poisoned by Heliodorus. Now, there are two opinions as to who was behind the murder. Heliodorus himself, who desired to take over the throne for himself. Or it could be Seleucus IV Philopater's younger brother, Antiochus IV Epiphanes. Well, if you look at the reign dates, Antiochus IV Epiphanes took over in 175, and Seleucus IV Philopater ended in 175, but it was not a smooth transition. Antiochus IV Epiphanes was not a son of Seleucus IV, the poisoned Seleucid emperor, but he was rather the brother, and brothers don't necessarily succeed. Now, Seleucus IV had two sons who would normally succeed. The oldest one was Demetrius. The youngest one was a five-year-old boy named Antiochus. Now, Demetrius was in Rome a hostage because Rome had managed to swap out Antiochus IV Epiphanes for Demetrius. So we got Demetrius, who would be a logical heir, and then the five-year-old boy Antiochus, whom Heliodorus was using as a means to advance his own cause. Antiochus IV Epiphanes is now out. He tried to get some help from the kingdom of Pergamum in northwestern Asia Minor, that kingdom that eventually handed itself over to the Romans. And Antiochus IV Epiphanes is going to be involved in a whole lot of intrigue in order to get the throne for himself. He pretended to be on Demetrius' side. He pretended to be the protector of the little baby Antiochus. He was a weasel. At any rate, all of that story is very interesting when you read the history. But the result is that Antiochus IV Epiphanes takes over in 175. Now, going back to his older brother, Seleucus IV Philopater, Daniel says in Daniel 11:20 that Seleucus IV Philopater will be shattered, though not in anger or in battle. That's because he got poisoned. There was no fight. There was no murder. There was no war. He just got poisoned. We go now to Daniel 11, verse 21. In his place, in the place of Seleucus IV Philopater, a despised person will arise, and that, of course, is Antiochus IV Epiphanes. Remember, Antiochus IV Epiphanes showed up all in Daniel chapter 8 as the little horn. There was two little horns, one in chapter 7 and one in chapter 8. The one in chapter 8 is, by common consensus, Antiochus IV Epiphanes. So this is a important guy. Also, we're going to see that he desecrated the temple in Jerusalem, which had to be rededicated and cleansed. That was done. The Feast of Hanukkah was established. So Antiochus IV Epiphanes was the indirect cause of Hanukkah. So he's a big deal. He's also used by a bunch of futurist eschatologists as a type of a future Antichrist, which I think is a speculation gone too far. But at any rate, he shows up a lot, so we need to know about him. Remember, he had gotten out of his confinement in Rome by being swapped for his brother Seleucus IV Philopater's son Demetrius. Now, this man was despised. Why was he despised? Well, John Gill says he was a very immoral man, given to drunkenness, lasciviousness, uncleanness, and unnatural lust, and a violent persecutor of the Church of God. His own father had no use for him. Usually hostages were changed out after 3 years, but Antiochus IV Epiphanes was a hostage in Rome for 11 or 12 years. So apparently Antiochus III the Great, his father, didn't think too much of this guy. Antiochus IV Epiphanes made himself ridiculous in the eyes of the people. He would ramble about the streets with a servant or two. He would converse with tradesmen about their trades. He would drink with strangers and people of low life. He would revel in merry bouts with young people. He would throw away his money among the rabble. He threw stones at those that followed him. He would wash at the public baths among the common people. There's one thing about being a man of the people, it's another thing about losing your royal dignity. Why was he called Epiphanes? Well, Epiphanes means illustrious or God manifest. He named himself that. I am Antiochus IV, God manifest. He was an arrogant son of a gun. Now, Daniel says in verse 21 that royal honors will not be given to Antiochus Epiphanes IV. As John Gill says, his father, his brother, the peers and people of the land of the kingdom of Syria never once thought of making him king, because he was a jerk. So he didn't start a war to take over the kingdom. He will come during a time of peace and seize the kingdom by intrigue. He had to politic to get the kingship. There was no bloody revolution. He pretended to come in as a champion of Demetrius against Heliodorus's little boy, his little boy that he was in charge of, the five-year-old Antiochus. And so Antiochus IV Epiphanes says, I am Demetrius's man. So the Syrian leaders let Antiochus IV Epiphanes in, and he worked his intrigue and he ended up on the throne. Antiochus IV Epiphanes had sailed from Athens, where he was after he was released from Roman captivity. He went to Pergamum, northwest Asia Minor. When he heard of his brother Seleucus IV Philopater's death, he got Eumenes II of Pergamum to help him. He also got Eumenes' brother Attalus to help him. He then went back to Seleucia, to Syria, to thwart Heliodorus' designs on the throne. He did so with his allies' help. And, in fact, he became co-regent for Seleucus IV Philopater's baby son, Antiochus, the five-year-old Antiochus. So he was pretending to help the older brother Demetrius and the younger brother Antiochus. But 5 years after Antiochus IV Epiphanes has finally gotten himself put on the throne, the little baby Antiochus was murdered in 170 B.C. while Antiochus IV was conveniently away out of town. So you see all this intrigue that Daniel predicts is going to happen. It did happen. As John Gill summarizes it, Antiochus IV engaged in intrigue with the nobles of Syria. He gave flattering speeches to them. He gave gifts to the citizens. He made great pretensions to clemency and humanity. He flattered Eumenes and Attalus of Pergamum. And so, with a lot of intrigue and a lot of skill, he takes over. We go now to Daniel 11, verse 22. A flood of forces will be swept away before him. That's before Antiochus Epiphanes IV. They will be shattered, as well as the covenant prince. Now, who are the forces that came against Antiochus IV? All the competitors for the crown, such as the forces of Heliodorus. But all of those forces will be swept away because Antiochus IV shows up with Eumenes and Attalus, or at least he shows up with the forces of Eumenes and Attalus from Pergamum. He shows up and sweeps away all of his opposition. The forces that are opposed to Antiochus IV will be shattered, as well as the covenant prince. Now, who's this covenant prince? Now, there's some dispute on this. I think the majority opinion is the covenant prince here refers to the Jewish high priest Onias III. Now, I'm going to tell you the story of Onias III because his story has already showed up in Daniel 8 as we discussed that. So we're going to mention him again. And before I go any further, let me say that Benson and Poole both say for certain that this is who the covenant prince is, Onias III. The Cambridge commentary says most probably it's Onias III. Ellicott denies firmly, no, it's not Onias III. So there's dispute over this. Well, here's what happened. Onias is the high priest at this time. I don't have the exact date. This is, yes, I do. In just a minute, I'll give you the dates. Onias III is the high priest. Now, there was a brother of Onias named Jason. He made a deal with Antiochus IV. Jason bribed Antiochus IV to remove Onias and make Jason the high priest in Onias' place. So, Antiochus IV, loving money, of course, forced Onias out and installed his brother Jason as high priest. That was in 174 B.C., about a year after Antiochus IV had taken over as emperor of the Seleucids. 2 years later, in 172, Jason the high priest was sending money to Antiochus IV, tribute money, and he sent a priest named Menelaus to send the money. But Menelaus took that money, Jason's money, the tribute money, added some of his own to it, and bribed Antiochus IV to secure the high priesthood for himself, for Menelaus. So we're going to call Jason briber number one, little briber number one, and Menelaus big briber number two. So Antiochus IV says, "Ooh, I like that, more money." So Menelaus then goes back to Jerusalem and deposes Jason, of course, under the protection of Antiochus IV Epiphanes, and Jason flees for his life. So when Daniel says the covenant prince will be shattered, most of the commentators say that refers to Onias III getting deprived of his high priesthood. But there are other opinions. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that the covenant prince is the prince with whom a covenant was made. In other words, Antiochus IV made a deal, a covenant with a prince, but then reneged on it and destroyed such a prince. Who could that prince be? Jameson, Fawcett, Brown suggest Demetrius, the son of Seleucus IV Philopater, the older son. And of course, Antiochus IV had agreed to support this older son, but then shafted him. So maybe that's the covenant prince who was shattered. Morris says it was a Ptolemy somewhere in Egypt who was involved in a covenant with Antiochus IV. Barnes says the reference is rather to the king of Egypt, with whom a covenant or compact had been made by Antiochus the Great, and who was supposed to be united, therefore, to the Syrians by a solemn treaty. I don't know what treaty he's referring to. That's a little vague for me. Another suggestion as to who the covenant prince might be would be Eumenes or Attalus of Pergamum, who, as I said earlier, supported the claims of Antiochus IV Epiphanes. And apparently, speculation, Antiochus IV breached his agreement with them. Well, all that speculation, I think Onias III fits quite well here. So I'm going to go with the majority report there. We go now to Daniel 11, verse 23. After an alliance is made with him, with Antiochus IV Epiphanes, he will act deceitfully. He will rise to power with a small nation. Now, this alliance that Daniel was talking about being made with Antiochus IV Epiphanes was with Ptolemy VI Philometor, who had now become ruler of Egypt. In fact, Wikipedia says he was considered the last ruler of ancient Egypt when Egypt was still a major power. His mother was Cleopatra I, who, if you recall, was Antiochus IV Epiphanes' sister. Antiochus III the Great, the father of Cleopatra I and Antiochus IV Epiphanes, had given Cleopatra I in a marriage alliance to Ptolemy V, and Ptolemy V and Cleopatra I had this baby boy named Ptolemy VI. And so that means that Ptolemy VI was actually Antiochus IV Epiphanes' nephew. He was a mere teenager when he took over in 180, and Antiochus IV Epiphanes sought the influence of his nephew because he saw the weakness of Egypt. He said, if I can go down there and pretend that I am looking out after my nephew, then maybe I can sneak my way into power in Egypt. And so once again, Antiochus IV Epiphanes is acting deceitfully, as Daniel says in Daniel 11, verse 23. He will act deceitfully. He will rise to power. That's Antiochus IV Epiphanes will rise to power with a small nation. Holman Christian Study Bible Translation, that's not a good one. The NASB in the Bible in Basic English says he shall rise to power with a small force. The ASV, the Darby, and the KJV says he will rise to power with a small people. God's Word says with a few people. The New American Bible says with a small party. The Young's Literal Translation says with a few of the nations. In other words, he goes down there with a few troops and he has power because he pretends to be the protector of Ptolemy VI Philometor, his nephew. The Egyptians apparently were unaware of Antiochus Epiphanes IV's true intentions. Now a little background here. Antiochus IV Epiphanes is trying to get back title to the contested lands there in between the two kingdoms, Coelus Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine, the Holy Land. Now those lands had been granted to Egypt by two means. One was by treaty after the Battle of Ipsus in 301, which is a good time before this, but also by dowry when Cleopatra I had been married to Ptolemy V Epiphanes. Cleopatra I had been sent with a dowry by her father Antiochus III, and so now the land belongs to Egypt, say the Egyptians, say Ptolemy V Epiphanes and his son Ptolemy VI. But Antiochus IV Epiphanes is not going to stand for that. Here's what Barnes says. He shall endeavor to evade its claims, the claims of the Ptolemies on the disputed territories. He shall endeavor to evade its claims. He shall refuse to comply with its conditions. He shall not deliver up the provinces according to the terms of the compact. This is the deal that Antiochus IV had made with Ptolemy VI. The history accords exactly with this, for he did not intend to comply with the terms of the treaty, but sought every means to evade it, and finally waged a succession of bloody wars with Egypt. In reference to the terms of this treaty and to secure their respective interests, both parties sent ambassadors to Rome to urge their claims before the Roman Senate. So the alliance was made, treaty was made, but immediately Antiochus IV Epiphanes tries to evade the terms of the treaty, and then in verse 23, Daniel 11, he will rise to power with a small force. So now he's in power in Egypt because of his sway over Ptolemy VI Philometor. We go now to Daniel 11, verse 24. During a time of peace, he will come into the richest parts of the province and do what his fathers and predecessors never did. He will lavish plunder, loot, and wealth on his followers, and he will make plans against fortified cities, but only for a time. Now, Antiochus IV will come into the richest parts of the province. It's not clear what province. It could be provinces in Egypt, but most probably it's the disputed territories, the Holy Land, the beautiful land, Israel, and Lebanon, Coelus Syria. And so Antiochus IV Epiphanes decided to do what his predecessors never did. He had a novel plan to gain the Egyptian-controlled provinces. Israel and Lebanon. He moved into the parts of the kingdom that were the richest, and then he did something that no other Seleucid king had ever done. He spread around spoils from his war campaigns to secure the loyalty of the people. Notice in verse 24, Daniel says that Antiochus IV Epiphanes will lavish plunder, loot, and wealth on his followers. The historical book of 1 Maccabees states that Antiochus IV Epiphanes spent much on the public. We read in 1 Maccabees 3, verse 30, he feared that he should not be able to bear the charges any longer, nor to have such gifts to give so liberally as he did before, for he had abounded above the kings that were before him. In fact, it was reported that Antiochus IV Epiphanes would go into the streets and throw money to the citizens there. Now, not only did Antiochus IV Epiphanes do that, but also he will make plans against fortified cities. He visited Egyptian strongholds to find out their power, but this was done only for a time, not forever, but for a time limited by God. Calvin says that for a time means gradually, because Antiochus IV had to gradually figure out how to take the strongholds. But at any rate, he's got his eyes on Egypt. We go down to Daniel 11, verse 25. With a large army, he will stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south. The king of the south will prepare for battle with an extremely large and powerful army, but he will not succeed because plots will be made against him. So after all the intrigue for 5 years between 175, when Antiochus IV Epiphanes took over as emperor of the Seleucids, down to 170, he's plotting and intriguing, trying to get power in Egypt by pretending to be Ptolemy VI, Philometer's protector. Finally, he gets fed up with all this and says, I'm just going to attack. So in 170, Antiochus IV decides to take Egypt by force. And this was at the beginning of what is known as the Sixth Syrian War, which ran from 171 to 168. I don't know why the war started a year before Antiochus IV's decision to go down there. Perhaps there were some other skirmishes going on. I don't know. But at any rate, Antiochus IV in 170 moved his army to the border of Egypt. And then he was met by a large Egyptian army at Pelusium near the Nile Delta, the northeastern corner of Egypt as you're going up toward Israel. And in this battle, the Battle of Pelusium, Antiochus IV Epiphanes actually risked death. He rode into the midst of the battle himself personally. He won the battle. He ordered the Egyptians to be taken alive instead of being slain. And by this policy, he gained Pelusium and later took the city of Memphis on the Nile River, right south of where the seven branches of the Nile come together. He wasn't able to get Alexandria, though, and so for the rest of the Sixth Syrian War, Alexander was a bone of contention. So Daniel says in verse 25, the king of the south will prepare for battle with an extremely large and powerful army, but we will not succeed. He didn't succeed at Pelusium, he lost, because plots will be made against him. Now these plots were devised by Antiochus IV Epiphanes and his counselors against Ptolemy VI, such that Pelusium was not lost because of lack of preparation or an insufficient number of soldiers or a defective military skill and courage. The reason Pelusium was lost was by the treachery of Ptolemy VI's own courtiers and commanders, especially two named Eulaeus and Linnaeus. They were the guardians of Ptolemy VI, Philometer. Remember, he's still a teenager. There was also another soldier named Ptolemy Macron who deserted Ptolemy VI. Plots would be made against Ptolemy VI, and that's why he lost. Now, I'm assuming, as Adam Clark does, that the plots were instigated by Antiochus IV Epiphanes. James Fawcett and Brown suggest it was plots instigated by Eulaeus and Linnaeus, two of Ptolemy VI, Philometer's counselors, whoever was behind it. That's why Ptolemy VI, Philometer lost. We go now to Daniel 11, verse 26. Those who eat his provisions, those who eat the provisions of Ptolemy VI, Philometer, will destroy him. His army will be swept away, and many will fall slain. Those who eat his provisions mean those who are close to him. He was betrayed by his own people. For example, Ptolemy Macron, the governor of Cyprus, deserted to Antiochus IV. Antiochus IV made him governor of Coele Syria and Phoenicia. So that was a big act of treachery. So his, Ptolemy VI Philometer's army will be swept away, and many will fall slain. That, of course, was after the victory at Pelusium by Antiochus IV. Epiphanes, now his army will be swept away. That word is sometimes translated in the old translations as overflow, and that usually refers to victorious armies, but here it doesn't. It refers to Ptolemy VI Philometor's armies being defeated and dissipated, just like water. So we move now to Daniel 11, verse 27. The two kings, whose hearts are bent on evil, will speak lies at the same table, but to no avail, for still the end will come at the appointed time. Now, the two kings who are intent on evil, of course, are Antiochus IV Epiphanes, the Seleucid, and Ptolemy VI Philometor, the Ptolemy. After Pelusium was taken and after Memphis was taken, Ptolemy VI and Antiochus IV spent a lot of time there in Memphis, and they were discussing things. And Antiochus IV Epiphanes assured Ptolemy VI of Antiochus IV's concern and desire to protect Ptolemy VI. After all, I'm your uncle. But actually, he was plotting to overthrow Egypt the whole time. He was a snake in the grass. He had corrupted the nobles in Alexandria to renounce their allegiance to Ptolemy VI. Alexandria, of course, was the next city that Antiochus IV Epiphanes was never able to conquer. He wanted to. And I think that Antiochus IV Epiphanes was behind the effort in Alexandria to put up as a king the brother of Ptolemy VI. There was a big civil war between Ptolemy VI and his brother. I believe his name was Ptolemy VIII Physcon, if I remember. At any rate, Antiochus IV Epiphanes intended to set the two brothers against each other. So, their hearts are bent on evil, but they still sit at the same table talking away about how they love each other. So, Antiochus IV is talking hypocrisy, wanting to take over Egypt and to destabilize Ptolemy VI's reign, while out of the other side of his mouth, he's telling Ptolemy VI, I'm going to take care of you against all of your enemies. Now, how about Ptolemy VI Philometor? He's the other king who was sitting at table and whose heart was bent on evil. He says, oh, Uncle Antiochus IV Epiphanes, I'm so happy that you're protecting me. And, you know, this war that we've got going on down here, it's not me fighting you, it's one of my guardians, Eulaeus. But all the time he was working with the brother that I just mentioned to unite against Antiochus IV Epiphanes as they fought over the last remaining city in Egypt, Alexandria. So they sat at the same table that was in Memphis. The peace between them did not last because, as Daniel says in verse 27, they'll sit at the same table, but to no avail. The alliance is not going to work between the two hypocritical kings. The peace between them did not last, we're going to see in a minute. War is going to break out, and as Clark and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, neither succeeded in his object. Ptolemy VI did not gain full control of Egypt, neither did Antiochus IV Epiphanes. And Daniel says in Daniel 11, verse 27, the end will come at the appointed time. The end of what? Well, the end of the contest between the two kings, Antiochus IV and Ptolemy VI. That's Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's idea. Or, as Matthew Henry says, it's the end of the phony peace between Antiochus IV Epiphanes and Ptolemy VI Philometor. Either way, the whole thing is going to come to an end at the appointed time when God decides it's going to come to an end. Remember, God's behind all history. We go now to Daniel 11, verse 28. The king of the north will return to his land with great wealth, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant. He will take action, then return to his own land. The Holy Covenant, of course, is Israel. The king of the north is Antiochus Epiphanes IV. He goes back to Antioch after his machinations down there in Egypt with and against Ptolemy VI Philometor. So he goes back to Antioch in Syria, north of Israel, and he goes through Israel on the way. Now, I've got to point out to you that Antiochus IV Epiphanes did that twice. He returned to his land twice, once in 169 and once in 168. There's no question that he did that. But there is confusion in the sources as to what he did and when he did it to Israel. He whacked Israel both times, leaving Egypt, going back to Syria. As a scholar at the Hebrew University in Israel, Daniel R. Schwartz says, all agree that Antiochus IV Epiphanes oppressed Israel severely both times that he left Egypt. But how to reconcile the two accounts in 1st and 2nd Maccabees is such as a historical problem that scholars like to get into. I've read a couple of articles on it, and it's over my head. Doesn't really matter. We'll just conflate the two returns back to Antioch and talk about how terrible Antiochus IV Epiphanes was to the Jews. In verse 28, he goes back to Antioch with great wealth. And again, the first time he did that was in 169, according to Wikipedia. The wealth was all the wealth he took in Egypt during his campaigns down there. Now, on one of these returns, again, I'm not sure which one, but in one of them, While Antiochus IV was engaged in Egypt, a false rumor arose in Judea that he had been killed. This prompted the deposed high priest Jason to raise an army of 1,000 men and attack Jerusalem. Remember, Jason was the first little briber. He had been kicked out of office by big briber number 2, Menelaus. So Jason raises 1,000 men, attacks Jerusalem, captures the city, and forced big briber Menelaus to take refuge. And so Antiochus IV comes back to Israel in the middle of all that. When he got to Israel, again, either on the first return or the second return, 169 or 168, he commanded his soldiers to kill everyone they encountered, men, women, children. Within the space of 3 days, between 40,000 and 80,000 Jews were killed. A similar number were captured and sold into slavery. So this was a big deal. His heart was set against the Holy Covenant, as Daniel says. He entered the temple, he took the holy vessels, the golden altar, the menorah, the seven-branch candlestick, the table for the showbread, the cups for drink offerings, the bowls, the silver censers, the curtain, the crowns, the gold decoration on the front of the temple, all the silver and gold. He sacrificed swine on the altar, sprinkled the broth of the swine's flesh throughout the temple. Here's what Wikipedia says. Antiochus issued decrees forbidding many traditional Jewish practices and began a campaign of persecution against devout Jews. Swine were strictly unclean to Jews, but Diodorus wrote, Diodorus is the famous ancient Roman historian, but Diodorus wrote, Antiochus sacrificed a great swine at the image of Moses and at the altar of God that stood in the outward court and sprinkled them with the blood of the sacrifice. He commanded likewise that the books by which they were taught to hate all other nations should be sprinkled with the broth made of the swine's flesh. And he put out the lamp, called by them immortal, which burns continually in the temple. Lastly, he forced the high priest and the other Jews to eat swine's flesh. So, there's desecration by Antiochus IV of Epiphanes, which started the Maccabean Revolt. After the Maccabeans got control of the temple area, they rededicated the temple, and they had the first Hanukkah. We go now to Daniel 11:29. At the appointed time, he will come again to the south, but this time will not be like the first. Again, as I said, he went down there a couple times, once in 170, returned in 169, and then he went down again and returned in 168. Let me read you from the aforesaid scholar, Daniel R. Schwartz, concerning these two times, because we notice here in verse 29, he will come again to the south, so he went down there twice to Egypt. Here's Schwartz, quote, "One of the old but still open questions of early Hasmonean history pertains to Antiochus IV's visits to Jerusalem. Everyone agrees that Antiochus twice invaded Egypt and withdrew from it, namely in 170-169, Wikipedia says 169, and in 168. And everyone agrees that on his way back from Egypt, he robbed Jerusalem. However, our two main sources, 1 Maccabees and 2 Maccabees, which each report a visit and looting by the king in Jerusalem, differ as to the dating of the event. 1 Maccabees dates the visit to 170-169 BC, and hence refers the aftermath of Antiochus' first invasion of Egypt. But 2 Maccabees, chapter 5, reports his visit to Jerusalem only after the chapter opens with an explicit reference to Antiochus's second invasion of Egypt. And so the scholars will debate over what Antiochus did and when. Now in Daniel 11, verse 29, this second visit to Egypt, this time will not be like the first. How is it different? Well, things had changed in Egypt. Ptolemy the 6th, Philometor, and his brother, Ptolemy the 8th, Physcon, had reconciled. They were sharing power now, thus annulling Antiochus IV Epiphanes' alliance that he had made with Ptolemy the 6th Philometor. This reconciliation, of course, is what caused Antiochus IV to decide to attack Egypt to start with, started in 170. But on the second invasion of Egypt, Antiochus IV Epiphanes didn't have the same success he had on his previous expedition. And in fact, a very famous event occurred on this second invasion, as Antiochus IV tries to conquer Alexandria to get it back from Ptolemy the 6th. Popilius Lenus, the Roman ambassador, met Antiochus IV at Eleusis, 4 miles from Alexandria. The Romans were upset about the Seleucids making inroads into Egypt, and they wanted Antiochus IV to stand down. So Popilius Lenus presents Antiochus IV the decree of the Senate there at Eleusis, 4 miles from Alexandria, And the Roman ambassador told Antiochus IV to leave Egypt. Antiochus Epiphanes IV replied that he would consult with his advisors and decide whether he was going to leave Egypt. Popilius then drew a line around Antiochus IV with a rod in the sand. And that's where we get the expression, draw a line in the sand. Popilius says, I must have a reply to give to the Senate before you leave the circle. Antiochus submitted. He left Egypt. He withdrew his fleets from Cyprus and headed back to Antioch. Now let's read what Wikipedia says about this famous day of Eleusis. In Antiochus's absence, Ptolemy VI and his brother Ptolemy Physcon were reconciled, possibly after a brief civil struggle. Antiochus, angered at his loss of control over the king, invaded again in 168 BC. This is the second invasion. The Egyptians sent to Rome asking for help, and the Senate dispatched Gaius Papilius Lenus to Alexandria. And Antiochus was now prepared to march on the capital of Alexandria again. At Eleusis, on the outskirts of Alexandria, he met Papilius Lenus, with whom he had been friends during his stay in Rome. But instead of a friendly welcome, Papilius offered the king an ultimatum from the Roman Senate. He must evacuate Egypt and Cyprus immediately. Antiochus begged to have time to consider, but Papilius drew a circle around him in the sand with his cane and told him to decide before he stepped outside it. Antiochus chose to obey the Roman ultimatum to avoid a new Roman Seleucid war, a retreat that Polybius described as personally humiliating for Antiochus. The day of Eleusis ended the Sixth Syrian War and Antiochus's hope of conquering Egyptian territory. And, of course, this is probably why Antiochus IV was in such a foul mood when he was on his way back to Antioch, on his way through Jerusalem, and might explain why he did such a number on the Jews. We go now to Daniel 11:30, and we will finish this audio. Ships of Chittimah come against him, against Antiochus IV, and being intimidated, he will withdraw. Then he will rage against the Holy Covenant and take action. On his return, he will favor those who abandon the Holy Covenant. Now, the ships of Chittimah are the ships that are coming from Cyprus. Chittimah is usually held to be Cyprus. Some people say it's the Roman Empire. Let me read you what Wikipedia says about Chittimah. The name seems to have been employed with some flexibility in Hebrew literature. It was sometimes used to apply to the Romans, sometimes to the Macedonians or Assyrians. Well, here it would be the Romans, because the ships from Chittimah would contain Mr. Popilius, Mr. Gaius Popilius Lenus, the guy who drew the circle around Antiochus IV and say, don't cross that line until you give me your answer. Are you getting out of Dodge or not? So ships of Chittimah will come against Antiochus IV Epiphanes, and being intimidated, he was certainly intimidated by the Romans. He will withdraw, he did, headed back to Antioch, and then he will rage against the Holy Covenant. And rage, that sounds like he was pretty upset by what the Romans had done to him. And he took action. He encircled Jerusalem, attacked the city, plundered and set fire to the city, pulled down the houses round about the city, built a castle on an eminence that commanded the temple, slew multitudes of the poor people who had come up to worship, polluted every place so that the temple service was totally abandoned, caused all the people to flee from the city, and after returning to Antioch, he published a decree that all should conform to the Grecian worship, to paganism. Jewish worship was totally abrogated. The Jewish temple was consecrated to Jupiter Olympius. Now, again, I might have all the details of Antiochus IV's depredations against Israel mixed up because he had two different trips through Israel, and that might not be an artifact of the sources. It might be just because I don't know the sources well enough, but it doesn't matter. The point is, Daniel predicted this guy. And in Antiochus IV Epiphanes, on his return, Daniel says in verse 30, will favor those who abandon the Holy Covenant. Antiochus IV Epiphanes did not harm pro-Hellenistic Jews who had allied with Antiochus IV Epiphanes. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished part two of the wars between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. We'll go to part three in our next audio, and we'll finish up Daniel 11, and we'll take a little bit of a peek into the career of Herod the Great. I'm going to call the next chapter Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, and Herod the Great. I hope you stay tuned for this chapter, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.